I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Andrea Warner joins me again. Her new book, Buffy St. Marie, The Authorized Biography, is one of the highly anticipated books of the fall season, more than a biography that sketches out the early life, remarkable career, and the unparalleled work as a songwriter and entertainer. The book gives us St. Marie's voice as the author gives the reader candid insight about show business, her work, as well as the trauma of abuse. St. Marie discusses her experience of childhood abuse as well as intimate partner violence and offers her advice to those suffering. The book also provides a view onto the activism that St. Marie has committed to from early on in her life that continues today. What we get in this book is more than just a look back, but a look forward, because its author, as well as its subject, who is now 77 years old, are both actively engaged in decolonizing and indigenizing wherever they can. It's a useful book in that regard. Andrea Warner writes about music, feminism, and popular culture. She was first on this program in 2015 when her first book, We Ought to Know How Four Women Ruled the 90s and Changed Canadian Music, was published. It's a great book about four remarkable artists, but it's also a wonderful memoir. Ms. Warner is a contributor to CBC Music, Pitchfork, the Georgia Strait, and Exclaim. She was last on the program in 2016 with Lisa Christensen, her co-host of the podcast Pop This, which is a terrific show. This new book is published by Greystone Books. There will be an event Sunday, the 21st of October, at the York Theatre here in town with Andrea in conversation with Buffy St. Marie. This is part of the Vancouver Writers' Fest. Visit writersfest.bc.ca for tickets. The website for more is at theandreawarner.com. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Andrea Warner. Ms. Warner, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. The Ms. Warner threw me, and that I stumbled over good morning when I responded back to you.
Well, good morning, and I don't know, I've always introduced people like that, Mr. or Ms. or
Yeah, no, Mrs. no, no, it's rare that I get the salutation, as well as, like, you know, it's a different experience. It makes me feel very grown up.
I feel very grown up doing this, so we're in this together. What's really great in the book, and I'm giving away the ending, I guess, is... this friendship that you've developed with her, with Buffy St. Marie. And it's such a special friendship, because you're obviously two very different people. Mm-hmm. She is in music. You write about music. You're of different generations. But what's emerged is something very special.
It is. It's really special. I'm kind of constantly astounded and just, like, so grateful for it. Like, especially when we get to be in the same place together. Last week we got to unbox our book together at Greystone, and we got to spend some time together for a couple of days and hang out with her, and her best friend was in town as well. And, you know, it kind of constantly astounds me that this is part of my life now, you know? And she's just such a remarkable human being. Like, I knew that she was. This process has only deepened my appreciation for her life and her music and her activism. But also, like, just having her as a friend, you know, she's so hopeful. She's so joyful, and she's so smart. She's so curious about everything. And she really inspires me to be even more curious about the world.
You say in the book, that she changed you. In a way, like, I can't remember the term that you, in one of the drafts, the early drafts of the book, you wrote something.
Yeah.
And then she changed it, and then it just changed her perspective on how to look at things.
It did, absolutely, because I think that as a writer and as a critic, I tend to deconstruct things, and I tend to sort of tear down. And I think actually the literal phrase was, I said tear down, and she crossed that out, sent it back to me, and wrote, build up in spite of,
or create in spite of,
or something like that. But basically, she just sort of, like, took the sort of destructive nature of my language and flipped it so that it was always focused on the positive, always focused on the building up instead of tearing down. And I think that is such a useful, beautiful gift to give people for the rest of their lives in terms of figuring out how to just do anything.
How to talk to people.
Yeah.
How to solve problems.
Absolutely.
And this is not just something that she's done, say, at 77.
No.
This is something that she's done throughout her life. And so when we get to the beginning of the book and we find out where she comes from,
mm-hmm.
and I guess the origin story, to use the phrase that people are using, I hear it on your show all the time.
She's a real superhero, yeah. So origin story is perfect.
So she was born where?
Well, she was born, she believes, on the Paiapot Reserve in Saskatchewan, and then adopted out of that reserve, adopted sort of in quote unquotes, and then raised in Massachusetts by a predominantly white family, or mostly like white family, and then was reunited with her Paiapot family in her early 20s.
And she went to UMass, is that right?
She did, yeah. She went to UMass. She also was in a program that sort of found her taking classes at a bunch of different colleges.
Like Ivy League schools,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So she from the beginning, even in college, she created the program basically that she wanted to serve, her purposes. So she's no stranger to sort of constantly seeing that it doesn't exist. No problem. I'll make it.
Yeah.
That's sort of been her approach.
We'll talk about Cradle Board in just a sec. But what I find fascinating is this inquisitiveness or this wanting to change whatever's there.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess at the beginning as well, was her musical ability, was that always there?
Yeah, absolutely. So she was just, she sat in front of a piano at the age of 3 and she was able to play. She could hear music in her head. She could listen to her brother take piano lessons. She could sort of mimic that mm-hmm. right away. She was composing and playing from, I think of 3-year-olds that I know right now, and, I love a lot of them, but none of them are sitting at the piano and improvising music. But that's what she was doing.
And so I guess one's born with that. I mean, you write about music all the time
mm-hmm.
through your work. Is that talent? Is that something that one's born with, say?
I mean, I think in her case, for sure,
yeah.
Definitely something she's born with, but it has continued to be something that she works on as well. So you can, I think, you can have a natural inclination towards something, but like anything, the more you use it, the better you get at it. And I think I don't think she's ever thought, okay, well, I'll just take for granted that I'll always
coast,
be able
yeah.
to do this. I'll coast.
Yeah.
No, she is constantly innovating and reimagining and experimenting all the time.
So other than what you've just said about her,
mm-hmm.
she realizes early on that there is great power in music and
mm-hmm.
there's great value in music.
Yeah.
And that's something that she obviously thinks of today and,
mm-hmm.
and using her voice. Using her work to say inspire others and encourage that in others. What is it like? Could you paint the scene where we are, say, in the early 60s when she first breaks, I guess, before It's My Way comes out?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, she was starting to write songs, in college and playing songs for people. She was quite shy. She was, again, coming out of, you sort of said in your intro, she was coming out of a childhood that had various instances of abuse, and she was coming out of trauma, and she was sort of learning also more about her identity as an Indigenous person and the history of Native American people in the States at the time, as well as then when she came to Canada and learning a little bit more about Indigenous people here. And so her approach, I think truth has just always been just has always appealed to her so much. She always wants to find out the truth about things. And she also knew from a very young age that, a way to engage people is to work always with facts.
Mm.
So she sort of cultivated early on what she calls if only you knew storytelling and songwriting. So that's, she was writing Universal Soldier. She wrote Now That the Buffalo's Gone. Those are both on her first record in 1964, but she wrote those in 1962.
Mm.
She was performing them for a few years before they became an album. And her purpose was to, she said, and I laughed so hard when she told me this, but of course it makes so much sense. She thought of herself as a journalist. Like, she was spreading the news, which is the way, so, like, you know, hundreds of years of folk songs have been spreading news. Mm-hmm. And she really sort of picked that up, and she did it in such a specific way, because she wanted people, she knew that it would be controversial information, not because the information was controversial, but because people are very...
People weren't talking about this
People weren't talking about it. Yeah. It was going to come out as shocking to some people. People get very afraid when they're challenged, and particularly when you're challenging ideas of what power is. She knew that she needed to have sort of what she called, you know, bulletproof, fact-checkable stories in her songs.
That first album, 1964, and you just said that some of the songs were written, I guess, earlier than that, 62. As a critic, when you... talked to her about that album, and she has various thoughts on it, as well as some of the early stuff that she's written that's been covered by everybody.
Absolutely.
Until
It's Time for You to Go.
Yeah, everybody covered that song,
right? Everybody's covered, and it's actually my favorite Buffy song.
Her version, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. She also talks to you in the book about the Bobby Darin version, which that's sort of my genre of music that I like to hear. Mm-hmm. So I went to YouTube to listen to it because I hadn't heard it before. And then the one comment was that it's better than Buffy's version.
Yeah, but I disagree so much.
And she does as well,
and
right?
And she does as well because, you know, she created something that had a musical tension to it, a sexiness to it. Because it is a song it's sort of veiled, but it is a song about female sexuality from 1965. So of course he took it and flattened it.
He turned it into bus tickets.
Yeah. Which I laughed again so hard. She's so funny. That's the other thing, people. Like, that's a real joy. I hope people get out of this book and what I've really truly found out in the last couple of years. She's hilarious.
Yeah, and she's not even at 77. She's always constantly learning, and she's always done that, right?
Absolutely.
You talk in the book about how she had one of the first Macs, and she used that not only to whatever people use computers for, but she did it for art.
Yes,
and she composed an album on it.
Mm-hmm.
But back to the music for just a sec.
Sure.
As a critic, because now you're listening to this as a fan. You're listening to it critically as a critic, and then you get to talk to the artist about it.
Yeah.
Does that change how you listen to not only that album, but the rest of her work?
Well, I mean, it doesn't... It shifts it a little bit because now I know how she felt, that she wasn't a fan of the vocal takes of that record from 1964, particularly It's My Way. And I understand I understand why she's not a fan of those takes. I still love that record, and I see it as, you know, I think of it as really sort of the ultimate folk record of the folk movement of the time. I think it's powerful. It's talking about things that people haven't really ever sort of talked about in song. It's incisive. It covers a tremendous amount of ground, and particularly social ground. Like, she's talking about addiction. She's talking about colonization. She's talking about the war and alternative conflict resolution. I mean, she's also talking about, like, as a woman, doing things her own way. So she's at the forefront before there's really even sort of a women's liberation movement. So all of these things are going on in this record. And then to find out that there's this other side where she was really disappointed with aspects of it, part of that is kind of heartbreaking, but also part of it is just like, of course, like even someone who's making a record that is, I just think, sort of timeless, it only tells one part of the story. And I'd always rather know the full picture of the story, even if it sort of changes my understanding of it, it doesn't dampen my appreciation for it.
And that must be such a gift for you because you've obviously listened to her for so long, and then now to know, say, the backstory and it really it makes the work all the more special, doesn't it?
I think absolutely. You know, I don't. I also sort of, like Buffy, really enjoy the truth of things. I like to unpack it. I like to analyze it. Again, we talked before about sort of my tendency being a bit perhaps rooted in the destruction and deconstruction of things, and hers rooted in the building up. It's those two are not, they're not sort of opposite things. They have a relationship to each other, and I think you can do both, and that's sort of my goal going forward.
So when the album comes out in 64, had she met people like Joni Mitchell? Had she met people like Leonard Cohen?
Not, I don't think, in 1964. As far as I know, she was meeting them in about 65.
I see.
Because when this album, 65 to 67, I would say, in that area.
Because when this album comes out, I guess that's the debut that brings her into this world, right?
It does, yeah. And she moved to New York for a little bit, too. But she, you know, 65 to 67, I would say, because Joni, you know, she carried Joni Mitchell's tape in her purse for a long time. She carried Leonard Cohen's tape in her purse for a long time. Buffy was always trying to make space for artists that she loved and get their music heard by the right people. And those things sort of happened, I think, after It's My Way, because that's when she had that cultural capital a little bit.
Because she's a musician and she writes music.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's an incident in the 60s, I guess. Does she start acting or she was invited to do an episode of The Virginian?
She was invited to do an episode of The Virginian. Leo Penn invited her, the director, and that was in 1968.
I see. Okay.
And so, yeah, she was invited to do an episode of The Virginian, and her demand was, because it was a Western, and they wanted her to play an indigenous woman who had gone to college back east and was deciding whether or not to come back home.
Mm-hmm.
And so she said, okay, I will do this, but only if, A, you hire all indigenous actors to play the indigenous people, and you give my character more complexity than the quote-unquote indigenous princess.
Yeah.
And that was sort of, you know, those were her two things that she could make those demands, and chose to make those demands because, as she says in the book, she didn't care if she got the part. Yeah. It was much more important to her to sort of, like, show them that this was possible.
Yeah, and I mean, this is like an inclusion writer before Frances McDormand, right?
Way before. Yeah. No, and I think these are kind of sometimes the demands that you can make if it's not sort of like an ego driven thing.
And it's not. I mean, there's an incident in the book where she's asked to introduce someone at an award show,
mm-hmm.
and she's given the script, and she rewrites it.
Mm-hmm.
Not because of ego, as you said. It's because she wants it to be properly representative.
Well, that's like, and I think that's always just been her goal. Yeah. It's never about the ego. It's always about the people and the movement and what's right. And she has such a strong sense of what's right. And I really admire that about her, because I feel like it's something she's had almost her whole life. She's always trusted her gut in a really beautiful way.
We touched on the abuse that she suffered early on, and I mentioned in the introduction the abuse in the marriage with Jack Nietzsche.
Mm-hmm.
She says in the book, where I found the book useful mm-hmm. was that I'm sure people will read this and get to hear what she thinks or what people should do who are abused.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's why you wrote it in the book, is because she wants people to know that, right?
Yes.
This abuse in the marriage, she stayed in that marriage longer than she should have.
Sure. I mean, it's hard for people to leave, and I think that she wonders why, even now, how she could have stayed so long. But I think that that's something that a lot of people who are eventually able to leave an abusive marriage, and be safe,
uh-huh.
look back and wonder how they could have stayed so long. But really, that's actually usually an act of staying safe. You stay because you're sort of put in this position where your confidence is eroded, your safety is always in question, and you are in this sort of day-to-day survival mode, and you're not really yourself anymore. Like, outside of just the fact of him being an alcoholic and, you know, volatile, there's a lot of gaslighting that goes along with that kind of behavior that is, like, constantly putting it onto the partner that, you know, you're triggering this behavior. I have no responsibility for it. And I think, you know, we see how she's not even sure how that happened.
Yes. There's a moment where she tells you that some of it, I guess she chalked up to because he was a genius.
Yeah.
That this sort of volatility was expected.
Well, and that's when we go, like, the myth of male genius, you know? We see that all the time, especially in Hollywood, how much it reveres mythologizing volatile men and giving them a pass because they're so brilliant. They're so this, they're so that. Of course, lots of people get sucked into that as well. You know, I certainly have in the past. Or this idea that, you know, we see the good sides because there are good moments where a person might be funny or, you know, so smart or so sensitive and then has these sort of shifts. And it's not, that's the thing, it's usually not always 100% bad. So it's hard to recognize when it's really truly time to get out of there.
And I mentioned it a moment ago, the abuse early on. It's difficult to read in the book just how much she's gone through.
Yeah.
But what's remarkable in the book is her ability to survive. And there is something instructive there, isn't there, for the reader?
I mean, I think so. I think, you know, I think anybody who's going to read the book who has had any kind of similar experiences or identifies with it in any way, there's always sort of a moment where you might feel sort of like inspired or hopeful. I hope that people feel seen in the book. I don't know that anyone can necessarily provide any kind of instruction, but ideally they can just provide some kind of landscape in which to sort of see yourself, see your situation, and feel sort of a kinship in that vulnerability.
I think we all learn about ourselves through others. And so this is her story, and I think people will get what they need out of it, right?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I hope so. I really want people to feel, you know, empowered by reading this book. I hope that they do.
The terms decolonizing and indigenizing.
Mm-hmm.
One might think that they're the same thing. They're not.
I don't think so, no. Yeah. I mean, I can only speak as sort of a white settler here.
What does she say, though?
She talks about, you know, decolonization being it's just an easy, simple, pleasurable thing to do because colonization really, it makes victims of so many people. It is, she constantly sort of reminds people that colonization, you know, was white people coming for them, their poorest and their most marginalized people first. And she's sort of really adamant about talking about sort of how all of these power structures that we have in place that keep people, keep the very like 1%, super, super 1%, and everybody else sort of in that area of oppression, that is colonization. And so indigenizing is very different. That is making space for indigenous representation, indigenous visibility, indigenous people in sort of all areas of our world.
And that's something that you've tried to do in your work as a critic, right?
I mean, I've certainly tried to. I want to. I think that that's the best or one of the best uses that I can make of my white privilege is to make space for other stories of people who do not look like me.
And when she talks about it, and she talks about the way forward, if you will, she is hopeful, right?
Yeah, she is. And I mean, I find that really inspiring because she's been advocating for more than 50 years in sort of these political areas, but she's also, she's survived a lot. She's seen a lot of things, and she has this really beautiful love for humanity that she still believes in.
And animals, too, I understand.
Animals, and humanity, and she's a really hopeful person. And I think that that is kind of an extraordinary thing. I mean, it's not to say that she sometimes doesn't get, you know, upset or angry or anything like that, or frustrated. But she, you know, she has been singing Universal Soldier since 1962. We are arguably in one of the worst times politically of our lives at this moment. And this song has never been quite, I mean, arguably it's as relevant now as it was back then. And, you know, she still absolutely believes in it. And when I see her perform it, and when I see the audience sort of just suspend themselves in this minute, you know, the song's only 2 minutes and 17 seconds or something. Uh-huh. Like, it's a really short song. And she's never blaming anybody, but she's making us all realize that we're all complicit. And in that complicity, we have the power to do something different. And I just think it's such an extraordinary, she's just such an extraordinary songwriter that she's still able to sort of believe in the messages of these songs and make us believe in the messages of these songs. And that, you know, it's, that's effective, like empowering, incredible music.
The other thing about her that in reading the book that the notion that I've been disabused of is because when you look at her, whatever age she is, and the photographs on the book cover, you know,
span,
her whole life, she's a striking woman, and Taj Mahal tells you that the thing that catches his eye first were the looks, and then he realizes very soon after that there's a great substantive woman here. Do you think that's dogged her a lot?
That she's too pretty?
Yeah, or that's probably the only way that people regard her as is because of how she looks, say.
I don't think so. I mean, I think that she has always been, she's never been one to sit quietly and idly by and just be a picture for people. She has always, always, always been talking and speaking and advocating and working and performing. And I mean, I think that, you know, she's smart about what show business is. Mm. She talks about how she knew that Joni had, you know, really brilliant songs, but that she was also, you know, beautiful enough that people would listen to her. So she knows that certainly beauty, like, opens some doors. I think it does more to open doors than it does to close them.
Yeah,
particularly in the patriarchy.
She's also very candid, speaking of that, about that it is a business. Show business is
absolutely
is as much business as it is show, say.
Yeah,
absolutely. What are the three rules that she has?
I think it's technically four, but I would have to actually, like, look at the quotes because I don't want to misquote her. But I know that it's basically, like, know when to divert the spotlight. So basically, know when to sit down, know when to shut up, and don't fuck the band.
There you go.
So, yeah, those are the general three things.
And the last rule, I guess, applies not only to tours, but
yeah. I mean, I think it's a good rule in general. Like, we can all take that and think about what our lives are like. You know, a lot of people can go home at the end of the day from their job.
Yeah.
But if you are taking if your job is to be on the road together, it's a good rule.
Yeah. I want to talk about the Cradleboard Project because I guess that's how I've sort of, in recent years, got to read about that somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I read your book, I find out that that was something that was early on, that she founded that, right?
She founded her foundation. That sounds clumsy. But anyways, she began her foundation in 1969 or 1967. Sorry, I can't remember off the top of my head. And then through her foundation in around sort of like officially 1996, the Cradleboard Teaching Project was born. It had been in sort of existence for a few years prior to that, but that really was sort of indigenizing, you know, education for young children in middle school and getting into high school. And that was providing different ways to look at science and history. No, actually specifically non-history, but like science and music, even sort of like mathematics. Like there's just a lot of different ways to look at sort of some of the kind of tired subjects that exist in our outline.
Makes it not only fun, but it's incredibly necessary.
Absolutely, yeah. Just like providing alternatives as to how we can get kids interested in school and interested in all of these different subjects, and then showing them these super cool ways that, you know, they perhaps never had thought about the physics of, you know, say a musical instrument. You can, if I had been able to learn about physics through musical instruments when I was a kid, I could potentially be much more interested in sciences now than I am.
And then art is something that she's always done, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I think
painting.
I think she got more serious about it in the sort of 80s and certainly in the 90s. Digitizing. She's got a digital studio and a wet studio, as she calls it. And Emily Carr actually is one of the first places to recognize her digital art and bring it and do an exhibition.
You wrote about her, I guess the first time that you. I guess the genesis of the book was about 3-4 years ago when you wrote about her for CBC Music, and that involved an interview. Is that right?
Yeah, we did our first interview in 2015 in April for Power in the Blood, and we just really had a wonderful conversation. I mean, I'd been writing a bit about her music before that, but that was really sort of the big meeting.
Yeah, and that was on the phone?
It was on the phone. She was in Hawaii in her studio, and I was actually visiting Toronto, and I was in the studio there. And we talked for, you know, the 20 or 30 minutes that you're allowed to talk or whatever. And at the end of it, I was thinking, oh, man, I don't want to get off the phone. And then she said that. She was like, I could talk to you all day. And I was like, oh, my God, I was thinking that too. And just from literally that moment, I was like, man, I wish more people knew just how cool and amazing she is. And then I really sort of started to think about, like, I think later that day I was like, I would love to write an authorized biography of Buffy St. Marie.
Yeah, and it's, so when we see the book in bookstores, as they will shortly, the word authorized, one wonders about that in terms of what, were there places that you weren't allowed to go in her life, say?
No, I mean, there are places that I knew that she's a really private person. She hasn't gone on the record about her family a lot. Mm-hmm. I felt like she really opened up to me in ways that she's just never gone on the record before.
Yeah, because when I'm reading the book, I'm everything's there, it seems. And,
yeah.
And there doesn't seem to be anything that's obscured or you know what I mean?
I don't press her to talk about her son very much because, I mean, it's just... I don't think it needs to necessarily be there. Like I tried to sort of enter her life through her music, because her music really has been a map of her life, I think, in every way. And so I always try to bring it back to the music and then bring it back to the sort of experiences that she's had. So we talk a little bit about Cody, throughout, but I didn't ask to interview him for the book. I suggested it, but you know, she was like, no, that's okay.
Yeah.
And so I just sort of leave that part alone.
Because
I really was I felt like I was already like, wow, she's really, really trusting me here.
Yeah, she was quite candid, too, when she talks about Cody and the regrets that she had. Because he's homebody's not the right word, but he likes staying in Hawaii.
Yeah.
And probably enjoys that a lot better than, say, going on the road as she does.
Yeah, and I think, like, I mean, you know, being on the road is not—it's not for everybody. It's hard work for her. She's, you know, jetting between time zones all the time. You know, I even just being on tour with her a couple times, and seeing like what she has to go through. It's exhausting, I think. And then she's so upbeat the whole time. She's got so much energy for the show. She cares so much about the performance. She's still feeling the songs every night. And then after, she was, you know, always doing these signings for people, like 150 people, each wanting their little piece.
Moment, you know?
And it just seemed like a lot.
What's it like to go to karaoke with her?
No, we haven't done it yet.
Oh, you
we haven't done it yet. We talked about it. We wanted to try and find something when we were in Sydney together, but we haven't done it yet. So I figure that's like, I don't know, maybe we're after we do the Vancouver Writers Festival, we're going to New York together for an event there, and then we're going to Toronto. So maybe during that week we'll have time to like hit up some karaoke. I'm not sure. I don't know that she necessarily wants to hear me do karaoke, but I certainly want to hear her do karaoke.
Oh, that'd be fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Such a good time.
What if you did go to karaoke with her?
Yes.
What would you perform? Would you perform one of her songs?
I don't know if she'd want to. I mean, I would be okay with that. I think particularly one of the really like rockin' songs, like Not the Lovin' Kind or something like that. But I think also, I think I would just love to hear her really like let loose on like, My Dream is sort of like a heart song, like just hear her do like Crazy on You. That would be super fun. Yeah. And then I could just do backup.
What, I just realized we've been talking about someone who is such a prolific musician.
Mm-hmm.
And it's odd to talk about someone like that without, say, listening to the music. But mm-hmm. So if you were producing this interview, say, what would you play into the interview and out of the interview that's of her?
Oh, man, you could do almost anything. Like, I personally love just the little sort of strummy intro to It's My Way on both the original and Power in the Blood version.
Uh-huh.
But I also love sort of the thumping and chanting of Starwalker, all of that sort of like bed of music and all the layers there. You could do almost anything. Illuminations has a lot of like, if you wanted to go for more of like a mystical route, you know, you could do something there. But I mean, she just has so much. We Are Circling is a really beautiful, beautiful song, I think, that, but also, Generation. See, anyway, there could be anything.
Yeah.
There could be anything.
What is she, the only thing I have here is the Betty Davis.
The Betty Davis?
The album.
Until
so,
It's Time for You to Go?
Yeah, so I guess that's the only thing I could probably play in here.
Well, I mean, it's certainly a version of Until It's Time for You Go.
It is.
It's
some version, though.
Yeah, it sure is.
What does she think of Up Where We Belong?
I mean, I think she really appreciates what it sort of gave her. You know, she has this Academy Award. She's, I believe, the only Indigenous award winner. Like, it's kind of, and her version is so different than Joe Cocker and Jennifer Warren's version. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, that's a beautiful version, and she really appreciates that and values that, but her version is such a much simpler, sort of humble song.
Yeah, because I've been preparing for this, I went to go to the thing and listen to it, Spotify.
Yeah.
And it seems to me, and you know, I haven't seen the movie, but obviously I've heard that version of it.
Mm-hmm.
Her version is what I think it meant, what she meant it to be, say.
I think so, too.
You know?
I think so, too. And I think it's a, you know, she talks a little bit throughout the book of different places where, you know, she really wanted a song to get out into the world and didn't care who recorded it. Other songs she felt a little weird at first that people were doing their own versions and then made peace with it. Up Where We Belong really kind of belonged to that movie mm-hmm. before she really recorded her own version of it. So it's a bit, I think it's a bit of a different relationship. It's more of like a reclamation for her version.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate that despite this remarkable catalog of hers,
mm-hmm.
that's probably going to be the first line, say, of the New York Times obituary years from now.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, who knows? Like, I think the fact that she's so vital, she's so relevant. If people just sort of dig into this moment and give it a chance, and you know, don't always think just about what came before, If they really, like, let her have her voice at this moment, you know, there's a whole other world that could exist for her for the next 20 years.
There's the event on the 21st for the Writers' Fest, and urge people to go. These things, unfortunately, sell out quite quickly, so if people...
They do, yeah.
People should get their tickets right away, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's been a... It's, from what I hear, it's been a very popular event so far for tickets, which is great.
Yeah.
I'm really excited about that, and I think it'll be... I think we have a really... I think people will enjoy, I hope, seeing us engage together on stage.
Yeah.
Because I think we have a lot of fun. I hope it's not... I hope it's not boring to watch. I don't think it will be. I think it'll be really fun, and I think people... All I've heard from people is how fun it is to watch us interact with each other. So that's... I think it'll be good.
Now, the Pop This, which you know I'm a big fan of, that continues,
Thank
right?
Thank you.
Every
yes,
week.
It does. Yeah. Yes, every week. We have not missed a week, and it's going to... We're going to be 3 years old in November. So that's exciting. And I don't even know how we've done that, but we've done it. Although, I mean, you do it all the time, so you know that you're going to be 15 this year or something.
But what, you guys are more fun. And I can't... I can't tell you, like I told you before we started, I sit here at my desk listening to you guys, you know.
Thank you.
And I just have such fun listening to it.
Thank you.
And it must be, well, it's a lot of, I understand the work involved in having to do something like that. But I mean, it must be fun for all three of you, right?
Oh, yeah. No, and I think the moment that it's like not fun, then you'll hear that in the recording and maybe it won't exist anymore. Like, I think we're still having a really good time. We're still having so much fun. And this is even me being like kind of not terribly good about being present for the last year because I wrote this book.
You've been and very busy, yeah.
I've been kind of busy. So yeah, I'm really excited about our third anniversary. We also are sort of helping to – we're going to be involved in the Vancouver Podcast Festival, which is November 8th to 10th.
Uh-huh.
And that's going to be really exciting. I'm pretty stoked about that. Lots of cool guests, and I get to interview some people, and I think we're going to do a live taping of Pop This while we're there.
Yeah. It's such a good show because you and Lisa are brilliant and funny, and the way you interact with one another, whether she says something funny and then you're reacting or you do the same. I mean, it's such an enjoyable I guess it's about an hour that you guys talk.
Yeah.
The show's about an hour.
About
I mean,
hour.
I there's some days or some shows where I'm thinking, you know, I just wish you'd talk a little. You know what I mean? Let's make this a little longer, even though an hour is a long time.
I feel like an hour is usually Andrea Jin is in the booth, like waving at us, being like, "Come on, wrap it up, people. We've heard you going on long enough." Yeah.
The dreadful question I ask authors whenever they come on, especially because this book is about to come out.
Sure.
Is what's next?
Yes, my favorite question. I have some stuff that I know that I want to do. I haven't written the book proposals yet. I was supposed to write them this summer. We got a little busy.
Sure.
There's been some stuff. But I'm going to write them really soon. But I know that I am hoping to co-edit an anthology with my dear friend and a super cool human, Sanara Geisler. Hopefully she won't kill me for saying that this is what I want to do with her. But we're hoping to co-edit an anthology on radical fat acceptance. And so we're very excited about that, just by people who identify as radically fat and are accepting and happy and want to sort of reframe those things for the world. And the other thing that I want to work on is I would like to... Okay, so because I love her so much and because she's been such a part of my life, I would like to do a collection of essays and interviews in praise of and celebration of Miss Piggy.
Mm.
So these are my two projects that I would like to work on next. I don't know if I will necessarily also throw in a third because that sounds like...
Maybe you can do anything, actually. You know?
I don't know about that, but...
No, I think... I mean, as you know, we first met when the first book came out, and I told you how I enjoyed that book a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
And not to patronize you, reading this book and that book, I mean, and then I read you in the paper, say, what a terrific writer you are.
Thank you.
And then I listen to you on the podcast. I mean, it seems like there's nothing that you can't do.
Well, thank you. I hope that's true. I would like to continue to just keep getting – I want to just keep working, and I always want to be better. And I know that, like, whether it's the actual writing or my thought process can get a bit more refined. I'm constantly sort of learning, I think, to hopefully be a better feminist and do the work of, you know, sort of do this justice work that I really believe in terms of decolonization and – sort of divesting from white supremacy and that sort of all of those models that we're sort of stuck in. Those are all the things I care about. So the fact that I can do that and have fun and make a living is pretty amazing.
Well, long may it continue. It's nice to see you again. And best of luck with this book. It's a very fine achievement.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this.
Visit writersfest.bc.ca for tickets for the event, the 21st of October at the York Theatre here in Vancouver. That's Sunday evening. And then, of course, Andrea's website, theandreawarner.com. The book is called Buffy St. Marie, the Authorized Biography. Greystone Books is its publisher. Its author, Andrea Warner, joined me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.